right, and here we are. This is the Working Title Show with Zach Sams, and we are back. All right. We are back. This is the Working Title Show with Zach Sams. We have a great show today, and it's February. Did you know it's February already? We're more than halfway through February in 2026.
It's been a rough week for you and I. So, I mean, we had a lot of fun in San Antonio.
I've recovered. You have.
No.
You don't.
No, too much work.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah,
too
right.
much work.
Yeah.
Too much work and not enough fun.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
That's what it was. You worked too much and didn't have enough fun in San Antonio?
I was doing so many deals. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We were in ICSC San Antonio this week. And
on the Riverwalk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tyler was a bad influence.
Their downtown is amazing. They've really done a fantastic job redeveloping a lot of that in front of the convention center.
Yeah.
Is that the downtown?
Where?
At the convention center? Is that what they consider downtown in San Antonio?
Is that a joke?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Riverwalk, it's not like the courthouse wasn't right there or anything.
Oh, Convention Center and the Riverwalk are right there.
Yeah.
Yes, that is downtown.
Riverwalk's downtown.
Sure.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I barely go to San Antonio, so I drive through San Antonio or fly over San Antonio, but I don't spend a whole lot of time.
I hadn't been down there.
And that's the problem. It's a very overlooked submarket in Texas that should be looked at again.
Yeah. Well, for what we do with residential housing, Northern San Antonio is kind of the upper end market. So there's some great communities there. Everywhere else is kind of like more blue collar.
Sure.
And the margins are really thin because the houses are really cheap. So it's hard to make money in those markets. So we kind of tend to stay out of San Antonio, but we do the northern part of town.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of it's San Antonio. Sometimes I forget about it. And I hadn't been down to I'm trying to remember when I was at the Riverwalk last, but it was
Wednesday night.
Well, before that.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Before that, I can't remember when it was. I think I was there with my wife because we always end up at that Dirty Nelly's Irish singing bar.
You told me all about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't make it there.
Well, we got a good show today. We have a great guest. Scott, do we say the ringer or the ringer?
Just Theringer.
Theringer. Scott, thanks for being on. Scott is the president or CEO and founder of M&A Development Company.
That is correct.
And what are y'all developing, Scott?
Well, right now we primarily focus on residential. So we have multifamily projects. We also have residential projects, but kind of our niche is residential subdivisions and feeding lot supply to the publicly traded home builders.
And when we first met, you had another company at that time, Allied.
Yeah, I was the CEO of Allied.
Right.
Yep.
And that was strictly focused on the subdivisions?
Yeah, similar. Their strategy was more of doing the entitlement work to get the zoning changed and flipping out of it versus what we do now is we still go out, tie up land, do the zoning change, but we actually go through and deliver the engineering and physically build the lots.
Okay. Like,
same thing on the multifamily side. I bought a piece of property in Garland 3 or 4 years ago, entitled it, turned it from an assisted living facility into an active adult 55 plus communities, took it from a single story product to a three story product, re-entitle it, do a new PD with the city, and then we're physically building that site. We also have two high rises in Uptown. One is on the Oaklawn area, four rent product, 21 stories. And then we have one that's right by the mansion in Turtle Creek. It'll be also 21 stories, but it's 44 for sale condos.
Okay.
So we kind of, I've got a background in retail and industrial, so I've done more of that than anything. But right now, the housing market, the way that it is, we've really focused on housing since about 2007.
What's your retail background?
When I was in California, I mainly focused on big box retail. So I did Home Depots, Targets. Basically, as the strategy is that you just follow Target and Walmart around, and there's that infill retail.
Yeah.
So you do the infill strips where you put the subways and the nail salons and stuff like that, or you do out exterior pads where you're building fast food or quick serve restaurants, stuff like that. So that was
well, I'm a big box retail guy. So
really,
yeah, that's why I was curious. And you're not wrong. It's all too often it's sheep following.
Yeah.
You know, the shepherd being Target and or Walmart or
Yeah, and I think it was a great business for a while, especially in Southern California with all the expansion and growth that was happening on the Inland Empire and Northern San Diego counties.
Yeah.
It was great because there was no retail and houses were going up left and right during the 05, 06, 07, and 08 period of time. It was fantastic. But retail, obviously, with the Amazon effect, retail's changed. So now we're just not.
You know, it's funny. Somebody was asking me. It was actually an Uber driver in San Antonio.
Yeah.
Okay, what are you here for? Shopping center convention, blah, blah, blah. What, you know, I heard retail's, you know, struggling. And I was like, as a matter of fact, it's the exact opposite. And because of a lack of supply for however many years, a decade almost, because 08 really knocked it down. And then the pandemic. And yeah. So you didn't have really any projects started for a while. I mean, we're at 90 in Dallas, Fort Worth right now. We're at 98.5% leased.
Wow.
So there's no space. And
yeah. That has to be a record. Has ever been higher?
Yeah. No, all time high.
Yeah.
And so.
Well, we're one of the hottest real estate markets in the country.
Yeah.
I think Texas is the number one place where everybody seems to be moving. Either Texas or Florida. And Dallas, with all the job growth that we have here and all the Fortune 500 companies moving to North Texas or Yall Street going downtown, there's just a massive influx of millions of people, and they all need a place to live.
Right.
And they all need grocery stores. They need to go to the hair salon. They want to go to restaurants. So if you look at all the retail on the north side of town, it's absolutely packed. One thing that we don't see is four lease signs in all the windows. So I think but it did take a huge turnover from everything that's happened since the financial crisis through the pandemic, that just there was a lot of disruption.
Well, and as a retail broker, selfishly, you there's no space to lease.
Yeah.
There's so not really the transaction dynamic. I talked to some of the office guys, and I'm like, what you have is vacancy, and that creates opportunity because you can then take your tenants and go, well, we're going to move over here, we're going to threaten or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, retail doesn't have that right now. And then you have the rising interest rate environment where stuff's not transacting as fast as it was on the sales side. So it's kind of that perfect storm of everything's full and we can't sell it.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see. But multi, I would think, is kind of in a spot right now, an interesting spot as far as the cycle.
Yeah, I think that, you know, a couple of years ago when rates obviously went through the roof, everybody thought it would hammer the single-family residential market, but it actually helped it out, oddly enough. And then for what we do, but on the multifamily side, I know quite a few developers that had a half a dozen projects and 90% of them got shelved.
Yeah.
And if they were going to deliver six, they might deliver two just because their basis was right in the property and it happened to be a really good market. But yeah, when those people don't understand how sensitive the performa is in a multifamily deal, that if you just have those couple basis points change, suddenly your return on cost isn't there and the numbers don't work and a bank looks at it and they get scared and then you can't fund a deal.
Yeah, and it's a kind of a tidal wave of bank sentiment that they heard their other banks dropped a couple deals. So, you know, that's a problem.
Yeah.
The fundamentals, it's not the fundamentals of the deal so much as it is a couple bips.
That's a big difference.
Big difference, yeah.
Well, and at the same time, insurance costs went up crazy in multifamily. So you had rates go up, insurance went up, and then rent increases flatlined or went down.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that multifamily seems like, I mean, it's all cyclical, but it seems like so cyclical because, you know, there's a shortage, you build up. We always kind of overbuild a little bit.
Yeah.
And then it's got to level out. And it's got to be, you got to feel like it's leveling out and that next ride's coming around the corner pretty soon.
The way that we look at multi is that it takes 3 years from the inception of a project until you deliver a unit.
That's going if everything goes right.
So you have all this inventory trying to come online. Then it finally does because 3 years previously, rent started to tick up and it gets everybody excited about the market. Everybody jumps in simultaneously. Everybody tries to get their projects off the ground, which means that now all the multifamily contractors are busy. Prices go up. Projects get harder to pencil. And this inventory comes online, but then suddenly you deliver all these units and you can't just once you turn the spigot off, you can't just turn it back on.
Right.
I mean, there might be projects that are sitting on the shelf, but now there's a year or two downtime where banks are afraid of multifamily. They won't finance the deals. Our project, we got tons of LOIs and term sheets from banks, but for a $21 million construction loan, they're like, well, if you put $10 million in cash on deposit, we'll give you that loan, which is just a ridiculous term that you're never going to do with the bank.
Yeah.
So they get so scared in their underwriting. We literally have banks say, we're not lending.
It's like a way they say yes, but they're actually saying
no. They're saying no, yeah. So if you give me all the money to lend back to you, then I'll lend you the money. It's like, well, if we could do that, then we would pay cash for the project. It's stupid. So, but it happens all the time. Conversely, on the residential side, it was great because when rates went down, everybody refinanced at 2 or 3%. Yeah. And then everyone's basis in their residential property was so low that if you were to sell it, now you're going to have to step up because your property values went up because 2 million people moved here.
Right.
Now you're getting your new rate at 8% versus the 2.9 that you currently have. Your property taxes go up, your insurance goes up, your mortgage goes up. But all you did was sell your $500,000 house to buy an $800,000 house, and you end up in worse financial condition.
Yep.
So it locked up the residential housing market. Nobody wanted, there was no inventory.
Yep.
So what it did is it drove everybody to the home builders who were smart enough to buy rates down.
Yep.
So while rates were at 8%, you could walk into D.R. Horton or Lennar or any of the big publics and you could get a 4.5% mortgage.
Right.
So it drove, there was no inventory. Plus the rates were high. If you went and did it on your own, you go into a subdivision, they've got a lender sitting right there and the rates are half. So a lot of people. So they sold out during, which is something we didn't necessarily see happening or anticipate because a lot of the builders pulled back and said, we're not going to do any more inventory.
Right.
So I actually got out of it for a year.
Yeah.
Weren't doing it until a friend of mine took over KB Homes, called me up and said, hey, I need to deliver 4,000 lots in North Texas. I need to get back into the lot business.
Like, huh?
And that was the trigger that got us back into the lot business.
Yeah, I think it was, I agree with you. It was a little bit surprising. We do all the First Texas Homes closings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was thinking the same thing, but then they just kept ginning.
Yeah.
And that was what, and then, yeah, that was the realization. It's like, nobody's going to sell their 3% rate unless, unless they get fired or transferred or divorced.
Death in the family or divorce or some job transfer or something like that. People aren't going to move if they don't have to.
Yeah. And so, yeah. But the population growth really didn't stop. Still everybody coming here. They needed somewhere to go.
There's still 1,200 people a day moving to Texas.
Yeah.
During the pandemic, our population grew by a couple million people. So now the whole shelf got raised as far as the number of people here. Those people have kids, people go to college, graduate. You know, it just, the housing still happens. The population still grows. The thing I love about Texas is we have the stickiest population out of all 50 states. 87% of the people that are born here stay here. So right now you don't have people transferring all over. A lot of people move to California, but then they move out of California.
Yeah.
Moved here 25 years ago, and a lot of people are vacating out. I got out really, really early, but a lot of people are still moving here from states like that are getting negative population growth.
So that's an interesting stat. I hadn't heard that before. 87% of people born in Texas stay
in Texas.
I wonder, but when people move here, they tend to stay too.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, because you meet people like, well, I'm not from here, but I mean, I'm kind of a Texan. I've been here 20-something years.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah. We used to jokingly say, if you've been here for 10 years, you have a pair of boots and a hat or a butt buckle, you're officially a Texan.
Yeah.
You're wearing cowboy boots. And so, you know, that's how you become a Texan. I think people they love the Texas lifestyle. They love the Texas attitude. There's so much more freedom here to be who you want to be and not get criticized for it. It's what I used to call faith, family, and football. It's just kind of just a great place to raise a family. And people come here and go, I can relax. I don't have to be uptight in New York or LA.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a neat state, and you know, in seventh grade they teach Texas history, and like it's one of the only states that teaches like their state's history.
Yeah,
I don't know if they still do. I hope they still do that. That's still happening.
Yeah,
hope they're doing it in a really positive way, like they did back when we were. I mean,
yeah, both of my boys. Anytime I want to know anything about Texas, I ask them what the history is because I don't know Texas history. I didn't grow up here.
Yeah,
like, oh no, this and this and this and this. There's all this history behind Texas. It's great.
One that creates that pride that you know.
Absolutely.
There's definitely
that come and take it attitude and pride. I love it.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's a problem today because I don't think across the nation they're teaching history the way they used to. And
across the nation, we're teaching everyone to hate the United States.
Yeah, I know. And that's a shame because, understanding that history is so critical to being an American and loving this country and loving the opportunity. And, people don't realize, you watch Twitter or TikTok and you think, that we're the worst country on earth when you listen to these crazies. But like everybody in the world's still trying to move here. So we still got something that's going on that's pretty good.
America is an amazing place. My wife is an immigrant. And
Your wife from?
Russia.
Okay.
And she grew up with the movies of the 80s and 90s when kind of the great, the Americana was still an amazing thing.
Top Gun
and Rocky Balboa and all those things and, you know, Die Hard. You know, she fell in love with American music. She fell in love with American culture. So when she got the opportunity to come here when she was 21, she's like, this is where I want to be. She moved to New York.
Right.
And so I think, you know, her growing up in a post-Soviet communist country, there's just a lot of things that people don't realize the way that the world really works in places like that.
Yeah.
Like if a Russian oligarch over there decided that he wanted to have you, he would just kidnap you. People would disappear all the time. You don't have the civil rights and civil liberties that we do. You can't speak out against anything because the police will show up at your door and beat the living daylights out of you. And there's just a lot of stuff that people don't realize, the freedoms that we have here. And we often, a lot of people end up acting like spoiled children when they don't really, and they want us to be like some other country when they don't realize how bad it is. And you hear the immigrants from Venezuela or any of those places that come over here like, no, you guys don't understand what it's like to be in a communist country.
Yeah.
Like, it's not always fun.
I almost think we need to have a reverse exchange program.
Yeah.
So that your kids come back and look at you and go, oh, thank you so much.
Yeah. Send your kids to go live in Russia for 3 months to see how they come back with a little bit different attitude.
Yeah, exactly. You want a work program in Russia?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Here's your hammer. Here's your rock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's your rock. Right.
Well, that's interesting. That's cool. So she came from Russia to New York, and then y'all recently met a few years ago in Florida.
Yeah, we've been together for almost 6 years now. We met during the pandemic when we were both on vacation in Florida, and we met and have found my other half, and so
there's only a couple places you could say that you were on vacation during the pandemic, and
Florida was one of them. Florida was open, so we went to Florida.
Yeah.
Yep.
So was she on vacation too? And
she was on vacation too, yeah. She worked in New York. She had a med spa. They shut her when New York was shutting down. They literally drew a line and said all of these businesses have to shut down. So her salon got shut down on one side of the street, but on the other side of the street was the open, and there was a McDonald's that would have 150 people in there that was open, and you could go to that, but you couldn't go into her med spa and get a one-on-one service.
But COVID was worse on that side of the street.
Yeah, exactly, because it doesn't travel across the street.
No.
Yeah. It only stays on this side of the street. And if you're sitting,
you're fine.
Then, yeah, because we used to get that. We'd go out to a restaurant in New York, and you're like, you're not allowed to walk across the restaurant. I'm like, why? Because COVID is up here, not down here. I can't sit here.
It hangs between 5 and 6 feet.
Yeah. We got kicked out of a restaurant because the restaurant manager didn't want us sitting next to each other at a restaurant because that was against the rules and we might give each other COVID. I'm like, this is my wife. If we were going to give each other COVID, we would give each other COVID.
Yeah.
We can sit next to each other. He's like, you're not allowed. And we literally got kicked out of the restaurant because we wanted to sit next to each other.
Just the level of insanity.
People just lost their minds.
Yeah.
Just absolutely lost their minds.
Crazy.
I wonder if, you know, because we were talking about retail and the pandemic and that, you know, it kind of, it changed after that. I wonder if like everybody got a dose of, you know what, being inside all the time and just having everything delivered to your door actually sucks.
Yeah.
So we're going to get back out now. I mean, you saw the country club industry went gangbusters after this.
People wanted to get outside and do stuff. And
with
our subdivisions that we designed, things have definitely changed to where people want a little bit more of a lock and lease lifestyle.
Yeah.
I think they're getting away. We either have a bifurcation where people want to go to Midlothian, buy a 1 acre lot and build a place where they can have the basketball court and the pickleball court and a massive pool and have all those outdoor activities.
Yeah.
Or they want to be in a condo or a smaller house in a subdivision where they have less maintenance, less care, so they can travel more.
Yeah.
And that's part of the experience.
But still the amenities of the condo unit.
And so you get these, and you get these massive communities that are doing water parks and freshwater lagoons and all this amazing stuff because they're trying to bring that resort lifestyle to a community, but the houses and lots are very, very small. Or you go over to the other side where you build all that into your own house and your own lot and subdivision, then you don't have to go have an amenity center to back that up.
Are you doing any of these lagoon type of deals? I just wonder about the lagoon 25 years from now.
Yeah, like, the thing, when you really commit to a lifestyle community like that, it's like a golf course.
Yeah.
Years and years ago, I was part of a group where we would buy golf courses. And one of the criteria for buying the golf course is it had to file bankruptcy at least once. Because the basis had to be low enough to where you could actually make money at it.
Right.
And so you build an entire community around this amenity a lot of times it's built by a guy who had too much money and didn't have enough sense, and he put $25 million into a golf course that only could cash flow about an $8 million asset.
Right.
So if it had filed bankruptcy at least once, then you knew the basis got low enough to where it could actually cash flow itself. Golf courses and all that have done great now, but now the latest thing is pickleball courts,
yeah,
pickleball tournaments, and country clubs are getting rid of their tennis courts and turning them into pickleball courts because it shifts. And we're very finicky with fitness and health, and there's all these new trends and everybody shifts over. And when you commit to a lagoon, what do you turn it into in 20 years when nobody wants it anymore?
Yeah.
It's a huge,
there was a community here,
financial
that,
commitment.
They built a big lagoon. My aunt actually bought a house in there, and
yeah,
it was, I think the lagoon was under maintenance for the entire 2 years she lived there. She was like, this is,
I just see those lagoons like 20 years later, like kind of algae
and blue lagoon
and like a floating cups in them and stuff, you know, because well, I mean, we all see all these great neighborhoods,
yeah,
20 years later. I mean, the HO, you know, it's hard to maintain those things for so long.
Yeah. And communities change because you'll get, you know, South Garland is a great example. It was the place to live in the 70s and 80s.
Oh, yeah.
It's no longer that case.
That's where my parents lived when they married.
Exactly. Yeah. And so our 55-plus community that we have there is surrounded by people that built their house in the 80s and never left. Well, they're now all 60, 70, 80 years old, and they don't want to leave. And so where do they go? Well, that's why we're doing a 55-plus multifamily building, so they can get rid of the house on the half-acre lot that's too big for them to take care of and move into a different facility. But neighborhoods change. People go through, you know, their kids are in elementary school. You see this, elementary schools die.
Yeah.
And the high schools get really, really big. And then the high schools die off because people don't leave.
Yeah.
Communities like Flower Mound, the elementary schools are struggling. The high schools are doing great. But once those kids move out of high school, there's not another younger population that comes in. So if you have a lagoon community that's designed with all these water parks to be around families and kids.
And the kids grow up.
Kids grow up. What do you do with the lagoon? Now you have, you know, it's the senior citizen hour at the lagoon. It just, they're huge lifestyle commitment communities. And if you can keep that going, fantastic. It's just for us, we don't do mass scale stuff like that.
And I would
drop
guess
that amount of money in it.
This is because of we're inside the loop, but I live in Lake Highlands, where when I moved in Lake Highlands, they were about to close the elementary school for lack of attendance.
Yeah.
And then they tore down about 2,000 units of really bad apartments, and the folks that had graduated from high school 25 years prior were getting married, and or I guess at that time it would have been 10 or 15 years prior, but like the 99 grads, that was kind of the last year, so 90 to 99. Well, they moved back. Uptown was hot. We all moved into Uptown.
Yeah.
We all lived down there, and you get a job in Uptown or downtown. You don't want to live in Frisco, and you don't want that commute.
Right.
So
you move to the M Streets, or
so you move to
Lake
the M
Highlands,
Streets, and then you realize your little tutor's too small. This isn't going to work.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, this huge wave of people started buying these 1960s ranch style mm-hmm. homes, popping the top, you know, and
on vertical with
and
it,
and going vertical with it. And now, I drive around.
Everybody I meet is in Lake Highlands. It seems
Because it was the center of the universe.
It was the hottest zip code. Zillow. One of the reasons that we sold our house is I built this house. And I went on Zillow, and because I had heard that Lake Highlands had the hottest, most searched zip code in the country.
Yeah.
I was like, all right, well, if everybody wants to be in this zip code, which happened to be my zip code,
yeah,
I was like, let me check and see what's on there. So I ran a search of every house over 5,000 square feet that was on greater than a half of an acre, new construction, and I came up with zero. There was actually one listing for a house that hadn't even broken ground yet.
Yeah.
So it didn't take you long
Lake
to sell
Highlands,
your house.
All of the MC streets. So we put on the market. We sold in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Over asking and, you know, over what we originally anticipated the house being worth. And so it just, neighborhoods, but I bought the house from an elderly couple that got too much for them to take care of the house and
yeah,
tore the house down and redid everything, did, you know, kind of completely rehab the existing house. And so I think neighborhoods do get gentrified, but it could take 50 years.
Yeah,
so if you got these bigger communities, are they going to rip the roof off and regentrify those in years? I don't know.
So yeah, that's my question, is like the rock walls, the McKinney. I saw recently McKinney had to shut down three elementary schools.
I haven't heard any of this with this elementary school stuff. It's very interesting.
Yeah. And so I'm trying to, from a macro perspective, better understand, like, are we inside the loop? Is that just something that's going to happen because you're so dense that it's the cycle's going to change? Or do you think this is going to happen to the South Garlands of the world, the Rockwalls of the world, the McKinneys, where there is going to be a change in 15 years where those people are going to retire, they're going to move out? Like, is there a site life cycle where, so like, is a school, what is a school district to do when you close elementary schools, but maybe in 15 years you're going to need them again? And that's $300-400 million worth of infrastructure you built. Like, there's got to be a better plan to maybe shutter one and then move kids, but then reopen it if you, I don't know the answer.
I think it's effective city planning. A lot of times we come across cities that we just beg them to be able to work with them and develop communities, and they just get so focused. And I won't badmouth them now.
Go for
although
it.
Yeah. I could, and I would really like to. But
that's
there's
our next episode. We're just going to shit all over all,
shit all over the cities. Yeah. But you get this not in my community attitude from the city. They don't want multifamily.
Yeah.
All they want is large multi-million dollar homes. And we try to convey to them that where's the new homeowner going to move to? Because if you have somebody who wants to stay in your community, if there's no $300,000 houses, they're leaving.
Right.
And if all you want is a house where a lot is 75 foot wide, well, if you're a publicly traded home builder, you deal in product of 35 foot wide lots, 40 foot, 50 foot, 60 foot wide lots. And for every width, there's a certain amount of depth that they maintain to where they can fit the footprint of that house on it.
Yeah.
Well, if a city says we only want 75 foot wide lots, then that mandates a certain size house.
Right.
And when I build a subdivision, I build it, the cost is measured by the front foot.
Right.
So if I have a 50 foot wide lot, it costs me $50,000 to build that, $1,000 a front foot. If I have a 75, now that costs me $75,000 to build that lot. But if the market doesn't demand anything greater than a $300,000 house,
right,
the builder's still only going to put a $300,000 house on it. But now the problem is that he can't afford to pay me the 75. He can only afford to pay me 50. So the numbers don't work, and I can't build the subdivision.
And the city, because they don't have time to listen to you explain.
And I try to explain, like, it's just a math problem. Like,
right.
It just, there's the economics of this. And like, well, just make them bigger. They'll come. We're like, but they won't, because we have a project in the city right now where the city mandates 75-foot wide lots, and their minimum is 100-foot deep. Well, everybody needs 125-foot deep. Builders just don't change their plans for the fun of it. They all
right.
They do the same plan over and over again because they get efficiencies out of those plans, and
right.
The city won't come off the 75. But the subdivision is in a neighborhood where the houses are $150,000. So no one's going to come in on a 75-foot wide lot and go, there's a $900,000 house. I know there's a double wide next door.
Right.
But go ahead and put the $900,000 house.
There's no downward pressure on the double wide being next door to the $900,000 house.
Yeah, it just doesn't work. And so you have to look at what is this little pocket of the city mandate? If these are $200,000 houses next to a brand new elementary school, that's a starter home community. We want to put starter homes in there.
Right.
And then we can move through the subdivision and do first time move ups, which might go from a 40 or 50 foot wide lot to a 50 to 60 foot wide lot. And the house goes from 1200 square feet to 2200 square feet. So, but it's a math problem of the economics of the value of the houses. There's only so much money and so much margin in it that can reverse back down to what it costs you to build the subdivision to make it work. This particular subdivision will deliver at completion $900,000 a year in tax revenue. But the city doesn't want to do it because it likes 75s and doesn't want to give you 60s. It's going to be the same size house. It just, the lots will be 10 feet shorter.
Well, in Frisco,
and the economics don't work. So now the city's going to, what's $900,000 worth of property taxes that grows at 3-5% per year for the next 50 years?
Right.
It's suicide.
Well,
it's stupid.
In retail, just, right, Frisco,
we don't get
same thing. Like it, when we looked at a project in Frisco, the employment around Stonebriar Mall would drive an average of 24 to 25 minutes to get to their job, which is a, you know, minimum wage job, retail job. Those are high school kids. Those are other, like, the kids in Frisco weren't wanting to work at Stonebriar Mall, and there was no multifamily to house the workforce. So they were commuting a long way, and there's no DART. There's no rail. There's nothing in Frisco to support that. So,
yeah.
I mean, that was a pretty big problem.
So getting back to your original question of how do we design around this, or how do you plan around it? You really have to have a city that is proactive.
Right.
One of the cities we're working with is Louisville. They've redone their downtown. Louisville was a great community 50, 60 years ago, yeah. but it's aged,
yep.
as all communities do, and they are really making an effort to gentrify their downtown. So they do a special district overlay of that downtown area that allows for developers to come in and put extra high density, extra height, extra things to make that community work. They understand that you need rooftops for retail. You know this is a retail guy.
Yeah.
If I have a town with less than 25,000 population, I can't get a franchise restaurant to go in.
Right.
Applebee's, Chili's, they'll say population's too low, you can't have it. Yeah. So you need rooftops to drive the retail. Retail is your services that bring new rooftops because people want to live in a town where they can go to Chili's.
Right.
Or have the basic amenities that you want to have. So we see communities that are kind of stuck because they're not big enough to get all the amenities, but they need rooftops. So this is seesaw, but you have to have a very engaged, reasonable city planning group or city engineers that's backed by a great city council and a great city manager. Unfortunately, too often, these towns get people that don't have the depth, they don't have the experience. It's a school teacher that wants to help the community. And these are all well-meaning people that want to try to help, but they just don't understand the economics in the back end.
Right.
And when I explain people, it's a math problem.
Yeah.
It's not, I would love to do what you want me to do. I just can't find an investor or a bank in the world that will back us to do that. So it's just never going to happen.
Well, and the growth's going to come one way or the other. And if they don't do it right, then you get these really jacked up. Like yeah. the one that, the like to me the most is Keller. Like they just let everything come in there.
Yeah.
And what you said, this really cool little, you know, old town look to it and everything is just, it's been just, they just let all the growth happen. And then you yeah. go to like a place like Justin, Texas, where they just refused everything forever and they didn't have
anything. Yeah.
And now it's changed, you know, over time. Eventually the growth is just so strong that it's going to happen one way or the other.
Especially but then, with what we've experienced.
Yeah. But there's then so you didn't plan it. It just kind of,
it's not planned.
Yeah. yeah.
Or there's some community with design standards that like Coppell, I think, or Fossil Creek, was it Fossil Creek? Yeah. Where, We have these 1991 architecture standards that everything has to be this color brick. It looked fantastic in 1992, and now it's aged, yeah. and you will drive through the community. You're like, what happened to this place?
Yeah, and the state legislator is actually trying to do things to help unclog it, which I think is fantastic that we have, as opposed to a place like California where they try to do everything to stop developers. They're actually trying to do stuff. SB Senate Bill 840 just passed that right. allows you to put multifamily on commercial sites by right.
Yeah.
So now you don't have to go fight a city, but cities are starting to do wonky stuff with trying to put different types of requirements on things that yeah. will bottleneck developers because they don't want stuff to go in. They want to be able to plan their communities. They also made it to where you can remove yourself from the ETJ of a nearby city. So that way you can get the water, you can get the sewer from different places and start to work to get stuff done. The challenge that we have is that when 2 million people moved here over the last 5 years, every available piece of property that had utilities got sucked up overnight.
Right.
And now we're, and I spoke at a conference a couple of days ago where some of the largest developers like Hillwood or Huffines were out there talking about their master plan communities and nobody has utilities. Because it's a town had a 20-year plan for the utilities for this amount of growth to come in and it all got sucked up in 9 months. And yeah. so now they're sitting here, and so now we're doing PIDs and MUDs and all other types of municipal financing vehicles to be able to pay for the infrastructure, to be able to.
So is it a cost issue or a planning issue?
It's now becoming a planning problem because they've got to figure out to do it. And a lot of cities that we work with are PID and MUD friendly. They're like, sure, we can do this because they understand they don't have the infrastructure.
Right.
And they yeah. want the town to grow, and they want to plan it out right. But we also run into cities that are like, no, you can't have a PID. Just no. Like, but there's no sewer and water. You can't do it. They're like, well, you'll figure it out. You're a developer. You're like, but this, like, I can't, the 125 houses can't support $10 million worth of utility infrastructure it's going to take to bring the utilities to this site.
And by the way, we won't support it unless you bring in Neiman Marcus.
Yeah.
And or Nordstrom's. Yeah. We'll accept Nordstrom's if it's not Neiman's.
Yeah.
Which is now bankrupt, unfortunately.
And they all want that. There has to be a blend. For a community to be healthy, you have to have a blend. You have to have product for every economic level. And I try to argue, like, when we have a subdivision, they don't want smaller houses. I'm like, where's your mom going to move to?
Yeah. yeah.
Where does a single mom move to if it's not these? It's 10% of the subdivision or houses that are under 2,000 square feet. Not everybody wants a massive two-story house. I know you want big, beautiful houses in your community, but there's other people that live in your community besides a middle-aged couple that each make $150,000 a year.
Well, they can afford it. It's an ecosystem. You have to have all the food groups to work.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you balance that ecosystem with multifamily for the people that work those retail jobs and don't quite have the income, or they're just transitioning and growing up and getting it all figured out, you have townhouse product where it could be a rental or it could be a smaller house. You have first-time buyer, first-time move up, and then you have the higher-end communities. You got to have a blend of all of it. And I just think that cities get these blinders on, and the people on council get blinders on, where they don't look at it holistically of what will work on this particular site, on this particular street, in order to make the community blend and go well. They tend to get a little blind, and that's what we have to fight every day.
Yeah.
If you look back at your own life, you know, like when I was in my early 20s, where I worked at a Chili's, I was a bartender, I lived in apartments, mm-hmm. you know, and which was, you know, you didn't make any money, you worked hard. Those are all hardworking jobs. Yeah. And then eventually you find your way, you get a better job,
and then you get moved up. Yeah, and it's an ecosystem. It happens over time. But there has to be a place for everybody to be able to have a roof over their head during that period of time.
So what regions do you guys work in?
Primarily, we're Texas only. But Northern San Antonio is a market that we like. In order for our financial model to work, we have to have a price point that's high enough in the house where there's enough margin in the deal. If you can make $10,000 a lot on a 300-lot subdivision, there's enough margin in there.
Yeah.
But if those houses are only worth where you can make $1,000 a lot, there's only $300,000 in profit. Now, if you guess wrong on one sewer line, you don't make any money.
Right.
So a lot of the South San Antonio stuff that we were talking about before the cameras turned on, Lennar's going in there and building a $200,000 house. The land is getting developed at cost. There's no margin in that. So for us, we focus on kind of the middle market, higher end communities where those houses are $400,000, $500,000, $600,000. So that's Northern San Antonio, all around Austin, Kyle, Buda, Georgetown, those areas around the nice new bedroom communities around Austin. We stay out of Austin proper. Same thing with Dallas. We've got our multifamily product in Dallas, but everything is Prosper, Anna, Salina, Louisville, all the bedroom communities around North
Texas. How far north are you right now in DFW?
Furthest north would be Prosper, Salina.
So not like
Anna up 75.
Not Gunner yet, anything like that.
Those communities are great, but it's a little bit on the edge. And our clients that we sell to are all the public home builders.
Yeah.
So it's a short list of about 20 people that will buy our product. And they, depending on who they are, they want to may make a market penetration into a certain market. So we'll have a lot of bidders on one project where one project might, there'll be only two or three guys in that entire community that will want it. So we have to go where they want to go. So you have your inner core ring, your first ring, your second ring is your bedroom community. Well, that green field third tier, they start to get a little waffly. DR will go anywhere. They're Texas-based, they're based here, they understand a little bit better, but they'll plant a flag out there just to get it going.
Gotcha.
But they want to go to the next community over. The home builders, they're building thousands of houses. They're a 900-pound gorilla, a freight train going in one direction. They can't just stop.
Right.
So what I try to explain to people is like they need to produce houses, and they have to keep their volume up because they can't lose their employees, they can't lose their vendors, they need to keep production up. And so they want to go where it's the next community over, or the next lot over, or parcel over, or ranch over, to where they can just take that workforce from that particular project and just move it down the street.
Right.
They don't like to go, well, let's go 45 minutes in the middle of nowhere and hope that people are going to do it.
Right.
There's that term drive for affordability. That's why we keep stretching further and further out. But right now, that kind of northern Prosper, Salina, Melissa, Anna, that's kind of the furthest north.
What's your sweet spot on like number of lots in a project?
For us, our largest subdivision right now is a little over 500 lots. Okay. Smallest one is 100. It's in Prosper. That 100 lot subdivision is all $1.2 million houses.
Oh, wow.
So smaller volume, higher price point.
Yeah.
Kind of the sweet spot is about 250 to 300 lots.
And are you delivering fully entitled, fully completed, finished lots.
Finished
with
lots.
Utilities and flat work and everything done.
Everything ready to go, installed. All the builders got to do is come and drop a house.
Streets, curbs, everything. Okay. Wow.
Yep.
Okay.
Interesting. You're one of the newer tenants in downtown Dallas.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The Bank of America Tower.
Yeah. Bank of America Tower.
New owners.
Yep. We were We were in the Turtle Creek area on Maple Avenue for a while.
Okay.
We needed a bigger space. You know, would look to go into a different building. And the unique things happen in Dallas where there's all these new Class A buildings gone up. There's a flight to quality. So there's a lot of Class B, Class C stuff,
yeah,
inventory. But you go in, it's kind of depressing to be in the building. And so we looked and found a space that was actually a sublease in the Bank of America building. It was a brand new office, been built inside of 2 years. And a gentleman who was our, we subleased it from, was a staffing company that went all virtual. And so they no longer needed the space, but he had 10,000 square feet. He's like, what do I do with this space? So the rental rate was good, and we moved in there. The downside of the Bank of America Tower is that you have to fight the homeless people and stuff around the building. It's just, it's a blight on the city to have that stuff happening down there, and it makes it difficult for you to attract talent and staff to come into that type of environment.
So you're down there every day.
Yeah.
How long have y'all been in that building now?
A year.
Yeah. Have y'all seen, we've been told improvements on that's been happening. Have y'all seen it, or is?
I mean, I think that from what I have heard on both sides is sometimes I hear the numbers are better. Sometimes I hear the numbers are worse. We heard Eric Johnson, the mayor, speak not too long ago, yep, and he said the numbers are getting better, but we still see all the events happening every day. And so we physically see what's going on down there. And what's crazy is if you go to the Art District, you don't see it. If you go to Uptown and go by the Crescent, you don't see it.
Yeah.
It's just downtown.
Well, it's just right by your
Stimmons,
building.
Or the Stimmons Corridor over there by like the...
It's bad by City Hall, and it's bad by us.
But it's also bad by you.
Down by City Hall,
right?
And the homeless shelters.
And yours is the Greyhound building.
Yeah, and us is Greyhound,
and it just
the
got
DART
purchased.
Station, the bus station.
Yeah. It just got purchased. Washburn's going to relocate that.
Yep.
I think that hasn't happened yet. It's closed.
It has officially closed. Their new facility, the building, I think, which is up off of Harry Hines, opened up, and they've officially closed it. They happened like a month ago.
I saw some of the craziest stuff I've ever seen right around that Greyhound building where, like, there were predators that would hang out there, and some poor SOBs getting off of a bus from Tulsa, and some guy's like, hey man, you want a joint and look for a buck? And he's like, sure, you know, whatever.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Yeah, sure, yeah, let's do weed right now. And they would lace it with K2, and I watched a guy go comatose and fall over flat in the street. Like, I thought he was dead. And
they all just came in and robbed them.
Yeah, they rob them, and they take their wallet, take their, like, everything they've got on them. And the paramedics, they were like, look, I hope you don't have a heart attack or a stroke in the city of Dallas, because we don't have the emergency services right now, because we're dealing with this every day.
Yeah.
And we're dealing with people that are falling over comatose. And I was like, well, he's dead. And they were like, no, he's not. What? And they were kind of treating him roughly. And
yeah,
sure enough, he came to, and he was real belligerent, and he was...
We had a potential employee show up for a job interview and was robbed in our parking lot. So how does that go as far as wanting to hire somebody and your potential employee gets robbed at street level? We have a great police presence at our building, but we've had stabbings in our lobby. They're right there where the rail system is and the DART station is. There's a lot of handicapped people that take the bus and the rail. A lot of them are kind of zombied out, and so they'll just go across the street and they get hit by cars all the time. Somebody got killed not too long ago. And so it's just a constant, that element. I always picture the soccer mom who's going to bring her kids downtown to go to, like, the aquarium.
Yeah.
Or go to Rothbard Museum or do any event downtown. And you have this element down there that would just kind of scare anybody.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you see this stuff going on. My staff walks to go to a restaurant and they see a guy defecating on the street.
Yeah.
And it's that kind of stuff. And I've worked with the state on homeless issues. You and I have a mutual friend, Monty Bennett.
Yeah.
He and I went down to Austin with his team, and we're hearing about what the state and the cities and the counties are trying to do on homelessness. And it's, your heart goes out to these people, because the people you see on the street are chronically homeless. These people that are out there, they're ex-war vets, they're addicted to something, and they're chronically homeless, and those are the ones that die on the streets. The state and the counties have capacity to take care of the single mom who's temporarily displaced, but it's those people, and there's not the laws on the books that will allow the mental health institutions to take people off the street and hold them for greater than, I think it's 7 days.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
they say it takes 90 days to stabilize somebody who's in that kind of condition where they can just take care of themselves and they're weaned off all the drugs and alcohol. But the state hospitals can only hold them for 7 days.
Well, and they also have to want to be rehabilitated. And if they don't,
it's a programmatic problem that is designed by the state. Like in Austin, for instance, I didn't even know until recently that they had placed 3 halfway houses right on I-35 right next to downtown. Mm-hmm. And they were busing people in like by the dozens and dropping them off at this halfway house. Well, you can't make them stay and you can't make them do their treatment, but they were just creating this funnel of people that they're dropping off near downtown Austin, and then everybody's like, oh, the homeless problem in downtown's terrible, and you know, they're busting them in. It's the hippies, it's the liberals, it's this, and I'm like, I'm not getting political. I'm saying, what? No, there's 3 halfway houses right here that are being bussed in. Same thing with downtown. You've got homeless shelters, and like it's a factory down there south of downtown where there's what, 24 nonprofits right there.
We have a homeless problem that we have to solve, but these people need treatment. They need to be someplace. They need to be housed someplace. It's just, where do you put it?
Yeah.
Because if you can't hold them in a facility and they can just get up and walk out the door, they're going to, these people are, if you see them, they don't have their mental capacity about them.
No,
they're not all there. They literally can't take care of themselves.
And so it's not like they choose at any moment
to be homeless. These people are like, they're not on the same planet we are. They're in a different universe. And so they just physically can't take care of themselves. But if you don't have anything on the books that allows the people that are trained to do this to actually help these people, you're going to get what we have, which is a bunch of people on the street. And so that's a challenge that they're working on. There's a great pilot program out of San Antonio where they've got great recovery rates. They're able to do stuff. But the state and the counties and the cities are working to try to get the laws on the books to be able to do that. So
if we could figure out all this fraud going on everywhere, we might have extra money to put towards it.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's crazy. You know what's so weird about the homeless thing is, like, we've always had homeless people in Dallas. I mean, that's not abnormal, but it seems like in the last, like, maybe since COVID, it just seems like it's exploded. Mm-hmm. Like with the tents and the, you know, and these like shanty villages that you see. Where was I? Yes, I was driving somewhere yesterday, and I was driving down, I wanted to miss the traffic, so I drove down Harry Hines, like through the medical area, and then jumped over on 35, and I was just like, just tents everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I just don't remember that 10 years ago.
No, there just wasn't there.
It's an endemic problem that is not just, like, Walmart just came out with their earnings today, and their earnings are up 4.7%, and their record sales. And I can't help but read through the article and think, like, well, it's because a lot of people are trading down to Walmart.
Yeah, exactly.
And they just don't, their dollar doesn't go as far as it used to. And I've got another friend that he owns a ton of what I would call class C and D multi-bay industrial. And he said, you know, 5-7 years ago, you got guys with brand new lifted F-150, and they're got their employees, and they've got welders and all kinds of activity going on, and happy to see you. And now he walks in his deal. One, they don't want to talk to him, or they kind of avoid him because they're late on their rent. Two, he said once or twice a week, somebody will break down and cry because they've had to fire all of their employees because they just can't afford them.
Right.
And it's that cadre of our society that is really, really struggling. And then, you know, you go, oh, well, there's this blow up of homeless people. Well, yeah, a lot of those people just lost their jobs a year ago, and there's not a replacement job. So I can talk an hour about that, but it's definitely a problem.
Well, I think with downtown, it has its unique challenges because you have Yall Street coming. So Goldman's coming in. All the other financial institutions are coming in. We have all the major engineering firms. We have all the major accounting firms. We spit out lawyers left and right. So there is a great element that's happening in Dallas that a lot of high-paying jobs are moving in. But with AT&T leaving downtown, it's going to leave a void in downtown.
Yeah.
And it's already challenging for the small businesses that are down there, and you'll see every other building is boarded up. And if AT&T leaves, then 10,000 employees leave downtown that go to the sandwich shop and stop by the convenience store.
Yeah.
And so those little buildings, those little businesses are going to really struggle to stay open. And there's a matter of time, you know, there's a year or two lag between when a convenience store no longer gets traffic and that guy burns through his savings.
Yeah.
It doesn't have anything left and gets late on his rent and his landlord bolts his doors.
Yeah. So I do think you have right now, you have a very unique opportunity, but an urgent opportunity that people are going to crap all over downtown. That's just, you have naysayers.
Yeah.
I would take the whole city council, go to, like, San Antonio, I'm going to harp on San Antonio. Like the brand new Monarch Hotel right in front of the convention center. They've totally redone the Riverwalk. They've extended it all the way to the Pearl Brewery. There's all kinds of really cool stuff. As I was down there, there were tons of pedestrians everywhere. There's not that many cars like zooming through downtown. They've got a bunch of bike lanes, a bunch of the bird scooter lanes, stuff like that, where it just felt a lot more vibrant with people everywhere. Yeah. Some homeless, but not a ton. Like
I didn't see a ton either.
No. Yeah. And
interesting.
And I think like with AT&T leaving, potential for the Mavs or not the Mavs, but the convention center, like you are definitely going to have 5 to 6 years of a rebuild phase. And then the convention center is going to come online. You're going to have, if they can ever get that thing off the ground. But then whatever happens with the AT&T building and that whole Discovery Center, it's awesome. It's great. Mm-hmm. Like, incentivize somebody else. Dallas is terrible at incentives. They really are. Every other community around here, whether it's Frisco or Fort Worth or whoever, is great at incentivizing people to come. And Dallas has got to figure that out.
Well, I think Dallas has got a unique challenge because in some aspects, Uptown, when I first moved here, none of those high-rises were here.
No.
Victory Park wasn't here. Yep. The AAC wasn't here.
Right.
So there has been a lot of positive. You look at the net numbers, the numbers are going up as far as businesses moving in and new buildings going up and things happening. But we have that age-old problem where you come to work downtown and then you want to have a kid and you want to go them to be in good schools. And being downtown Dallas isn't advantageous for that.
No.
And when I first moved here, there was less than 1,000 people that lived downtown. I think now the population's at like 15,000. So things are happening, but you have a huge economic void. Like if Neiman's goes out and AT&T goes out, there's not a whole lot left to do downtown. The Thompson Hotel building is going back to the bank.
Right.
And yeah. So there's all these challenges with downtown that it's going to take a great vision of the council and of the mayor to be able to figure out how do you fix that central business district.
And them working together for the first time.
And working together and doing something dynamic that is bold. I love Chicago. Downtown Chicago is amazing. And you have families and people coming down there, and there's a vibrant retail and all wraps around the river. They did an amazing job of planning out and working. What you say about Illinois and the craziness and all the stuff that's happening, most of that's on the south side of town. Downtown Chicago is amazing.
Yeah.
And we vacation there because we think it's a great city. It's a little bit smaller than New York. It's a lot cleaner. The people are a lot friendlier. So it's a great place to go if you want to be in an urban market. Mm-hmm. I think Dallas can be the same thing.
Yeah.
But it's going to take a great vision by the council and by the mayor and the business people that there's lots of money in Dallas.
Yeah.
We have a very deep bench of billionaires in town that love real estate, and I think someone could do something amazing with it.
But to your point, I think there's going to have to be some losers first to reset some of that basis and provide that opportunity where go, look, if you're willing to take the risk, there could be some huge opportunity down here. Yeah. But if you're propping them up.
The assets of downtown, I was told, is less than $1 billion or $8 billion.
$8 billion.
$8 billion. That's very small in the REIT world. That's very, very small.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of them are, you know, 10 times that.
Yeah.
And so the actual physical assets aren't that much. If someone took a holistic approach to redeveloping downtown, almost like create a REIT for downtown or get a partnership between all the developers put together, they could do that. The challenge becomes back to our previous conversation, it's about rooftops. How do you get people to live, work, and shop downtown?
But it's an ecosystem, and it's like Lake Highlands, Highland Park, Lakewood, they can all support the next wave of just like Uptown. Like, you don't have to have kids living downtown that are going to school nearby. Like, it can be, you know, young professionals, workforce, but yeah, you need.
Well, I mean, that's what Uptown was. Uptown was residential first, and then all the other things. I mean,
but you have the M Streets, you have Lakewood, you have over Swiss Avenue area. All of that's being gentrified and rebuilt. What we all jokingly call the Bridge to Nowhere. Now there's multifamily over there on that side of town. Highland Park is turned over.
Yeah.
It used to be that you could get $1 million tear down in Highland Park, and now you can't do that anymore. And they are actually building new elementary schools because so many people are moving there for the schools.
Yeah.
So there is a gentrification that's happening. Dallas was not the hottest place to live in the 70s and 80s. It wasn't that nice of a city. And then we went through our economic problems in the SNL crisis, which devastated the city for a decade or so. And it's taken 20 years for it to come back. But now it's back. Areas are redeveloping, but we need housing. Yep. And that's the challenge that we have. We have a multifamily building, and the community doesn't want the multifamily building to go in because they don't want their neighborhood to change. Even though there's five office buildings within a block of us, they still don't want anything greater than a couple stories because we're tearing down a two-story old 1950 garden style product that looks.
Is this on Turtle Creek?
In the Oaklawn area.
Okay.
And same thing with Turtle Creek. It's old 1970 vintage townhouse that's not attractive.
Yeah.
So you get this pushback from the community, and the city of Dallas understands that they need rooftops. But a lot of the people that have been anchored here for 50 years don't want to see their city change. Yeah. So it's a little bit of that, not in my neighborhood, not in my city.
Just about your Turtle Creek deal, you 40 units.
44 units.
And how many stories is that?
It's 21 stories.
And how, so a 21 story building, how many acres do you need to make that work?
That's on 0.6 acres.
Wow, that's insane.
Yeah.
How deep are you going with the parking garage?
Three stories down.
Okay.
Each unit, every bedroom has a parking space. So if you got a two bedroom unit or three bedroom unit, one unit, you have one parking space. So you basically figure out, there's a certain minimum footprint you need in order just to be able to make the basic drive of an interior parking garage. So that's kind of the footprint that hits your minimum. It's 0.6 acres. If you're over 0.6 acres, then you can actually make the drive aisles work. And then you just figure out it's every time you go down a layer in parking, it gets more and more expensive. The parking spaces are twice as much for below-grade parking as above-grade parking. In certain markets, you can do it by right to go above-grade. Like everywhere here in downtown, you can do above-grade parking, which is why you see all the parking garages. You don't have to go deep. But in certain markets, in order to be able to do it, you got to go deep.
So it's all your parking underground?
All the parking's underground.
Okay.
Each floor has two units. You take a private elevator from your garage straight up to your unit. It empties onto your unit. They're higher-priced units. But that there is a lack of supply of very nice high-end condos in town.
Yeah.
And so there's a couple of really nice buildings. The smaller units sold very well. The large units don't sell well. There's a condo building here in town that's got an $18 million for sale condo in it. There's about five people in the city that can afford that.
Right.
It's not the best price point to try to take a condo onto the market for.
Right.
The previous product that has gone out has been kind of a glorified apartment. And rents in Uptown weren't that bad, and you can rent a really nice apartment for $3,500. And if that same apartment in that same size unit in a condo, your HOA fees are $3,500 a month, not including your mortgage and your taxes, why would you ever move into a condo?
Right.
And so you have to differentiate yourself to produce a product to get to a price point at an income level where people at that price point don't care about the cost of the unit. They care about the quality of the building. So that's what we're trying to deliver, is a very high-end, bespoke, quality building for a certain clientele. The people that are selling their house in Highland Park or in the M Streets and don't want to be in a big house anymore, but they want to be in the city because they work for a lost firm in Uptown, they want a nice place that they can go and call home, and that's what we're trying to deliver.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
As we're out of time.
Are you out of time?
Absolutely. That was a great conversation.
It went fast.
Yeah.
It went real fast. Well, you'll have to come back on and...
Yeah.
We'll have to keep this conversation going.
Yeah. I'll give you guys updates on how the projects are going.
Yeah. And send us, if you have any links or anything, we'll link to the show on it. But this has been Working Title with Zach Sams. Thanks, Scott, for being here. Tyler,
appreciate it.
As always.
Yeah.
It was a pleasure.
Great conversation.
You got it. We'll see you next time.